Okay, this is 3rd March 1981, and we're at Queen's College in Cambridge University, talking with Ken Machen. Now, can you tell me what your training was at the university level, and when you first came into contact or heard about radio astronomy, please?
Well, my university training was in the middle of the war. I came up here in 1942, straight from school. Having spent rather a long time at school collecting one after the other A-levels, as they're called now, came up at about 18, did 1 year of natural sciences in a general sort of way, taking five subjects. At that time, electronics was compulsory. This was something inserted by the government into the curriculum, and four other subjects. And then at the end of the first year, they looked around, and those people they thought could do it, they suggested that they went straight on to the third year course in their second year. So in effect, I did my 3 year course in 2 years, whereupon I didn't get a degree, because you still had to be around 3 years to get a degree.
Oh, yeah.
I got a degree later, a year later, but left Cambridge in 1944 and went to TRE.
Which is in Malvern.
Which is in Malvern, that's right.
Right, Malvern.
It was the RAF half of what is now RRE.
Right.
There were two halves. ADRDE was the Army half, and TRE was the RAF half. We didn't really speak to each other.
And while you were there, did you hear anything about the effects of galactic background noise
on
receivers or anything like this?
Not at all.
You weren't aware of Hayes reports?
Wasn't aware of it at all, no. I was, in fact, doing some work in the basic centimeter group. But as you saw from that transcript, Ratcliffe pushed me into that because he thought a Cambridge physicist ought to be able to do physical optics, and I wanted to do circuitry. So he pushed me into the centimeter group, and I did circuitry.
Okay, you worked on these kind of things, and then when was it that you came to Cambridge University?
You mean came back?
Came back, yes.
Came back
right.
In
yes.
October 46.
And as you told in David Edge, that was because you had to put in 2 years, I believe it was.
Had to put in 2 years. In other words, having got you into the system, they didn't let you out too quickly. And Martin Ryle and Derek von Berg came back earlier than that. I don't quite know when. I think it wasn't a full year earlier, my guess.
I think it was late 45, I think.
Probably very late 45. Yeah. And then they were the first two here.
But you had already been signed up, as we see from that letter.
In effect, I'd been signed up by Ratcliffe, and I just had to serve my time. And one of the useful ways one could serve one's time was, in fact, to send a lot of the equipment from your lab down to the salvage department so that when you come back from the university, you could pick it up.
Okay, so...
So Harold Stanier and I came in...
Did you have any idea what you were getting into during this year?
Well, I and another chap came up to Cambridge, and Ratcliffe said, I think you ought to work with Ryle, and so I talked to Ryle, and it sounded interesting and exciting, and so yes is the answer. But there's very little background. It was still called Radio Noise from the Sun and Stars. Mm-hmm. And
Who was the other chap?
That came back in 46,
yes.
Harold Stanier.
That was Stanier, okay.
He was at RAE, I think, which is the Farnborough outfit. He was in the radio section there.
That's the Royal Aircraft
Establishment? Royal Aircraft Establishment. Right. He was, I think, an aerials man there.
Okay, so what does one do when Martin Ryle says, all right, we have this interesting stuff going on, and how do you spend your days in the beginning?
Well, it was a very cooperative group effort. In other words, there were lots of things to do, and we all did them, and it didn't matter who. As I said in the David Edge interview, the idea that you had your little project, which became your PhD thesis, was a total distortion of the truth. You just piled in and did everything. I would in fact do a lot of circuit design. Harold Stanley would do a lot of aerial design. We'd all dig a lot of holes and put a lot of fences up, and so on and so forth. And then when it came to the time, we'd carve it up and say, well, you have this bit, you have this bit of thing, which was not what was supposed to happen, but never mind. It was an efficient way of getting research done.
Right.
In the early days, it was very much work on the sun. There were only two receivers going, one on 80 megacycles and one on 175. This was using old looted RAF stuff plus a lot of German... a couple of very nice German rotating capacity switches and things like that. And In effect, these were running by the time Harold and I arrived. My brief at that stage was to develop some better circuitry, because Martin's original circuitry was still the feedback sort, in other words, balancing input noise against the noise diode with a feedback loop. But it had obviously been done rather quickly, and it was a bit unsatisfactory, and there were half a dozen thyrotrons in it, and when a thyrotron goes noisy, it makes more noise than the signal you're trying to receive, and various things like that, and the receivers were pretty tatty. And so the first job, which...
So it was a second generation
the basic equipment, right, which I was responsible for. Harold Stanier was then responsible for second generation aerials. And then we all piled in on analysing records, having ideas and this sort of thing, humping aerials about the place.
Right. Now, when you say second generation aerials, were the first generation ones simply exactly as they came from the military? And
No, they're all lashed up out of, you know, Dexin? Slotted angle.
Oh, yes.
Bits of angle iron. I don't think Dexin was invented by then. I withdraw that. I think they were welded up out of angle iron, covered with chicken wire, pieces of wood with polystyrene insulators on the top, and bits of brass tube and that sort of thing.
Yes.
Now, they were all ad hoc made. There was I don't think any of our aerials ever came off anybody's shelf.
Except the Würzburgs, in a sense.
Except the Würzburgs. Yeah. But then of course, the actual aerial element itself,
The feed, we
lashed up ourselves.
Right.
And Harold Stanier also got onto small Würzburgs and 500 megahertz, or megacycles a second, as God intended it to be called. So I suppose by his second year or so, he was not only the aerial man, but also the 500 megahertz man.
Okay, now at this time, there were the four of you that have been mentioned. Was there anyone else?
Well,
in those first year or two?
Graham Smith's wife was a research assistant with us. She was at TRE. Graham and his wife, Biff, which is variously spelled B-Y-P-H or B-I-F-F, but her real name is Elizabeth, were at Cambridge together. They were a year ahead of me, but I knew them when I was at Cambridge in 42. They were at TRE together, and then they came back together. Graham actually... in effect, repeated his third year.
Mm-hmm.
One of your options, having had the three-year course crushed into two, was you could either leave it at that, or you could do the third year again. Graham elected to do the third year again, so while I was doing my first year as a research student, Graham was doing his final year.
I see.
Biff was, meanwhile, our research assistant.
And what did she actually do?
Oh, build apparatus and things.
Right.
Build apparatus, analyze records. In fact, all the same things that we were doing.
But she never was on any publications, I believe.
No. And she really literally was for a year. She probably wouldn't be in on the ideas sessions. In other words, when we all sat on the floor and shouted at each other.
Right.
But she'd do all the things that we did, except, of course, we wouldn't expect her to go out in the mud and dig holes.
So, one question I wanted to ask, which I guess is relevant at this point, is that your first publication is in 1951.
What the hell was I doing between 1946 and 1951?
Well, I have an idea of what you were doing, but I'm just curious as to why there were no publications over that period. And obviously you were active in the research.
Yeah. I think two reasons. One is that I was doing a tremendous amount of apparatus. So there were lots of things. I mean, once one got the second generation sets built, the prototype, then of course we wanted a few production models because we were moving to different frequencies. The whole idea of the second generation one was that there was a core unit which was independent of frequency, then you had a front end which was frequency dependent. And so all these sort of tedious things like getting local firms to build them and getting all the, you know, the sort of paperwork and this sort of thing that had to be done. Also, probably about that time we moved up to the new field lab, but I can't remember when that was, about 47, I guess, and it was a matter of getting everything in school.
To Grange Road.
Well, it was Grange Road anyway, but it was a little wooden hut at Grange Road, as distinct from the brick hut at Grange Road. there are these two distinct
places. Okay, now, where is the first location?
The first location is as follows. If you go up, leaving the rugged ground on your left,
right.
As soon as you got past the rugged ground, there used to be a brick hut on the left of the road where the Ionosphere Group had their headquarters.
That's the first location.
And next door to that was a minute wooden hut, about big enough for sort of a garden shed.
Yeah, yeah.
And we had our gear in there. And then we were able to take over a brick hut up at the far end by the OTC garages. And there was quite a lot of work involved in moving up there.
Just a few hundred yards further along.
Just a few hundred yards further along, but about 20 decibels larger. And so there was a fair amount involved in
that. And that took place roughly when?
I can't date that exactly, but it must have been probably within a year of my joining the group.
But anyway, so,
you are
primarily working on equipment matters which don't lend themselves to publications.
Right, sure.
And is it fair to say, another thing I think I gathered from the Edge interview, is that you do not like writing things up?
Well, I didn't like writing things up under the conditions that we had in the radio group then, because Ratcliffe was very insistent on imposing his own style on things, which meant that anything you wrote rattled to and fro and had endless modifications made, which had got nothing to do with the science.
Yeah.
And this just got me down.
See, he just didn't have much motivation there.
Well, it's perfectly legitimate if you want to impose perfection on the style of the group's papers. But I felt there wasn't time for that. You know, there are more important things.
The fast-moving field. And,
yeah, that's right. One doesn't want to spend all the time on the sort of seventh draft, which is, roughly speaking, what the fifth draft was, with compensating errors introduced.
Right.
I think that may be some of the reason.
Okay. Well, let's go back to what you were actually working on during that time. What were the primary problems that had to be faced in this second generation of the what's usually called the Ryle Vonberg receiver, but it probably should have your name attached also.
Well, no, I don't think that's fair. I think everything in that group, I would say, almost certainly originated in Martin Ryle's head. And if he has the rest of our names on, then this is by courtesy only. I mean, he was the bright guy of that outfit, and he had more ideas than all the rest of us put together. And I'm not prepared to say that I want my name stuck on that. In fact, you see, the original Ryle Vonberg receiver was built by Ryle and Vonberg from this idea of Martin's of switching between the noise diode and the aerial and putting on feedback. I then cleaned it up and respectabilized it while not departing very significantly from the original.
And you went into some of the details of what's the best kind of response to have and the feedback and
that's
so forth.
That's the sort of thing. And the one idea I did have was this nonlinear feedback whereby when the thing was way out of balance, it would move rapidly, but as soon as it got near balance, its bandwidth would come in and the noise level would go down. So having it both ways, getting a fast response without having the equivalent wide bandwidth when it had settled down.
Oh, yes.
And that was a fairly useful trick. And the general analysis of the thing as a system, I suspect Martin Ryle and Derek Blomberg just built it, freaked it until it went. And in effect, my contribution was to have a great session on it, spending a long time optimizing things, getting maximum bandwidths out of video amplifiers, getting best responses and this sort of thing. And then also going through the thing, checking its response, because by that time we were starting to get rather fast bursts. As soon as we moved over from this dotting recorder, which I was telling you about, which was an immensely slow response, to something a little more modern, we were starting to see that there was high-speed structure in the thing, and therefore not only was the recorder originally limiting, but even when we moved to a new recorder, the equipment was limiting the response time.
Right.
And so, in effect, we had to have something which you got a faster response, even if it meant slightly higher noise level. So the ability to choose your response time, even if it meant sacrificing with a signal for noise, was another feature that went and so on.
Oh, yes. Well, let me ask more about Martin Ryle's role. You discussed this quite a bit in the Edge interview, but it hadn't hit me, really, or I hadn't thought about it for many years anyway, that he was started off as a research student also.
That's right,
the
yes.
Same as
yeah,
the rest
that's
of
right.
you.
That's right, yet, he was a PhD student.
And yet gradually he began to assert his authority. And,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I guess
well, he was older than the rest of us. He was also had a lot brighter than the rest
yeah.
of us.
And at what point did he get a lectureship?
That I can't tell you, but again...
It was while you were still there, though.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Again, that can be discovered in this annual
well, sure,
register.
Yeah.
If you go up to the university library and flog through those, look around 1948 or so in the list of university lecturers and see if he's there.
Yeah.
And then move either way until he disappears or appears, if you
right.
see what I mean.
But is it true, then, that he never got a PhD?
He hasn't got a PhD,
yeah,
no.
Right. So he just didn't bother with it.
That's
yeah.
right. Those are the days when you didn't need a PhD.
Yeah.
And I think you still don't, unless you're in America.
It's become a bit of a union card.
Yeah.
So that...
In effect, he gave up as a research student first. The time sequence is this. He arrives as a research student, just like the rest of us. After a while, he's so obviously running the thing and wonders what the hell he wants a PhD for, so he gives up being a research student. A bit after that, he gets appointed a lecturer,
and then
really
he's off. No
need then he's
to
off.
Do it. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting.
He, incidentally, had come to Cambridge just before the war. I think you'll find he graduated in about 1938. I think he then came and worked for a few months with the radio group here, before the war.
On ionospheric?
On ionospheric work, yeah. Probably, which gave him the sort of foot in the door, and then obviously came back.
Yeah, of course I have talked to him at length.
Yeah.
Switching subjects to, but the same era, what was your astronomical education like? I mean...
Zero.
It was formally that, but then you were getting these observations of the sun. How did you go about trying to interpret them in an astronomical context? Did you just get a book out of the library and start reading? Or
Talk to David Dewhurst, talk to Denise, talk to Stratton, talk to Newton, talk to people,
mm-hmm.
in effect.
And what about these traditional optical astronomers? Were they helpful with it? Or?
Oh, yes, yeah, you know, let's help this funny guy who thinks he may be able to tell us something. You know, maybe he will, but anyway, let's be helpful.
So I gather then you think that they were not putting great importance on these radio observations as really helping to give new insights into what the sun was doing?
I think that's right, and I think they were probably right, actually.
You think so? You think that the 5 years that you were involved, or even 7 years, you don't think that new insights came into the sun from the radio?
No, I think there's a lot of confirmatory stuff. I think that one confirmed, for instance, that the million degree corona was a real million degrees and not a sort of little cyclotron embedded in the photosphere or something like that.
Well, you were mentioning this earlier. Could we just
yeah.
Touch on that?
Yeah.
You had the impression that it wasn't really accepted by the...
Yeah, I had the impression that one had got these two bits of data. One was the spectroscopic work producing highly ionized lines, and that led to about a million degrees. And the other was the gravitational equilibrium of the corona.
The electron temperature.
That's right, with the measurements from eclipse observations and so on. And that said about a million degrees. But I had a feeling that the astronomers didn't really believe that this was the sort of million degrees that they thought were a million real degrees. In other words, I think they probably said to themselves, it is as if the corona
yeah.
is at a temperature of a
right.
million degrees. But I think by the time we were getting fairly decent absolute measurements, both of diameter and of intensity, and these were coming out at a million degrees, I think probably it was one of these things which was initially improbable and requires about three lumps of evidence rather than two before you believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that we might have been responsible. When I say we, I mean all,
yeah.
all radio astronomers
right.
were looking at the sun, which was about six of us. We might have been responsible, in effect, for clinching that million degrees. And then, of course...
So in this sense, they were paying attention to...
In this sense, they were paying attention, sure. But they would say, probably, yeah, well, okay, but we knew that anyway because of the 14 times ionized iron, you know.
Right.
But I think that we might have just pushed them over the brink.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, you've got the theoreticians with the accretion ideas for picking up the energy and the sound waves coming up in the photosphere and this sort of thing. That I think was probably later than 46 when those ideas
came. Oh, yeah, that was late 40s,
yeah.
More.
Yeah.
But what about the whole business of the sweeping and frequency indicating motions in the chromosphere and corona and so forth?
You don't think that this really... Hang on a minute. That was quite late. In other words, that was the Australian work.
Well, it began in the late 40s.
That's right. Yes. I think that was by about 1950, they were taking it seriously. I don't think we'd turned up anything startlingly original. Okay, so we said that there was a magnetic field in sunspots, so they would say, okay, well, we know there's a magnetic field in sunspots. And we say there are a great deal of irregularities in the corona, and they would say, well, we're not surprised. So I don't think we produced anything new until 1950 or something, and I don't think...
So you think it really was the swept frequency stuff that Wild primarily...
I would have thought so, yeah. I'd love to have done that. It's nice stuff.
Yeah, no, that is very nice.
But that's not to say that they didn't start cooperating. I mean, when we were getting the same answers that they claimed they knew anyway, it was nice confirmation, and they probably started taking it seriously.
Well, I like the quote that you gave David Edge about phoning up David Dewhurst on a cloudy day
and right, telling him there was a plane.
Taunting him.
Yeah. But of course, you see, remember that a lot of that flare work, which didn't, wasn't really getting anywhere by then, was still tied up with radio communications. And flares equals ionospheric disturbances,
right,
equals inability to telephone across the Atlantic, etc.,
right,
etc. So I think probably a lot of that we were doing because it was tying up with the ionosphere people, rather than because we had any idea what was going on the sun.
But now, do you think that Martin Ryle was interested in that tie-up, or was it only because Radcliffe was interested in that connection?
Martin always seemed to keep a pretty open mind, and Martin was always rushing ahead, and I think Martin was very interested on what was happening in the sun, but realised that other people would be interested in exact timing of flares and ionospheric disturbances for giving us propagation velocities and so on and so forth. It's a long time ago, you know, you're asking...
Oh, I understand.
Remember attitudes 30 years later.
You're doing very well. Now, there was a mention in your 1948 scholarship report about a correlation coefficient computer, which you apparently designed.
Yes.
And I was interested in physically, what was this, some mechanical device?
Let's go back a bit. We got our hands on an RRDE computer, RRDE being the successor to ADRDE, which was the Army establishment doing radar in Malvern. And they'd got a machine which worked on teleprinter tape, and it was extremely slow and extremely unreliable. I was keeping an eye on the developments in the computer lab because, of course, in 1946, Morris Wilkes came back to Cambridge and started work on ETSAC-1,
mm-hmm,
which is, of course, the first computer there ever was in this country. But at the same time, there were quite a lot of us who'd been brought up on analog computers and things like that for bombing calculations and so on that weren't quite sure about these newfangled digital things.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was a sort of half and half, half analog, half digital. In effect, I thought it unlikely that the computer lab, maths lab as it was then, machine was going to do what I wanted. And so I thought I'd do my own. In fact, it got nearly built when it was obvious that the best thing to do was to throw it away and do it on ETSAC.
Which would be when you made that?
Must have been about 1950, I guess.
Yeah, which is may well be the first time any radio astronomy data was processed in a digital.
Oh yes, I'm sure it was. I'm sure of that because, of course, nobody had got around to doing big Fourier stuff, and the sort of things that were happening in those days. To digress a little, very fascinating because Hodgkin and Huxley were working on the computer running their nerve impulse program, the thing that was calculating the form of nerve impulses from postulated changes of membrane permeability and so on. Mm-hmm. Teddy Bullard was busy fitting the edges of continents together before starting off on this big continental drift plate tectonic stuff.
Yeah.
All sorts of fascinating stuff was going on, because what you've got to remember is that autocorrelation program of mine, which had 1,500 terms, ran for 40 minutes. There were about 3,000 valves in EDSEC. The average life of a valve is about 3,000 hours, so once an hour it would break down. Now you can do a Poisson distribution as well as I can.
Yeah.
you were sort of fighting against it a bit.
Right.
Most programs that were worth doing ran for a length of time which was comparable to the mean time between failures of the computer.
Now, the input to your computer, was that punch tape?
The input to my computer was punch tape. I had, in fact, digitized things on a 0-32 system. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, there were motor-driven punch tape readers which operated relays, which, in effect, did digital-to-analog conversion.
Right.
And two in series would then multiply, and then one summed the thing in a Velodyne servo by just charging a condenser up to the voltage and dropping it into the servo, which would then make the appropriate number of turns and so on.
And the output would be in what form?
The output would be in the form of a mechanical counter on the front panel.
Oh, yes.
Revolutions of a shaft.
Uh-huh. And the...
But there comes a time when it was very nearly working. But it was obvious that you've got to cut your losses and go and use the machine that somebody else has built.
Right.
But it was fun. But as you see, my difficulty is I actually enjoy gadgeteering. And if you enjoy gadgeteering, you spend an awful lot of time doing it when you should be doing science.
Let me ask along the gadgeteering line a general question about, since you were especially in receiver development, what were the primary problems that you were facing at that time? What were the practical problems that you were trying to overcome? Was it a matter of getting down the system noise figure?
Signal-to-noise ratio always.
Even for the solar work?
No, not even for the solar work. There one had no trouble. One could use any crummy sort of receiver. And provided that you were prepared to accept an output time constant was fairly long, you weren't in trouble. It's the old battle of response time versus noise level.
Right.
If you wanted to look at the fine detail of the fluctuations of sunspot radiation, then you were in trouble with noise level. And that's probably...
And that's what you were trying to do.
That's right. I was doing it mainly from the trickery point of view, trying to improve the response time of the servo, because I wasn't much of a front-end man. In other words, I didn't know much about low-noise RF stages. Harold Stanier did a fair amount on that at 500 megahertz. Graham Smith later did a fair amount on 18175 on low-noise front-ends.
Did you ever work on any equipment that was being used for non-solar things
before? Oh, hell yes. In other words, this is the point about the cooperation. You didn't actually worry about who was doing what. In other words, if the receiver that you designed and built and repaired the previous day, because somebody has to mend it, and it always turned out to be Martin Ryle or me,
mm-hmm.
Was then to be used by Graham Smith and Tony Hewish the next day for looking at Cassiopeia, fine.
Yeah.
But and in any case, you see, I would want to borrow their aerial one day for my son, Fourier.
But the reason I ask that is that, of course, when you go to the non-solar situation, then indeed you're quite worried about noise figures.
Sure.
And stability.
Yes.
More so it seemed like that would be a different class of problems.
But there again, I don't think there was much improvement made on the standard equipment other than improving front-end noise figures. Until it came to phase switching, of course. And one day Martin had this bright idea. I think the advantage of phase switching is mainly just convenience of presentation. You clearly don't get any more information out of it than the original records, but you do cut out the wide sources, and hence, of course, all the confusion in due course with Sydney. But that was a case whereby Martin came in one day and said, "Hey, I've heard fantastic idea, you know, got a bit of paper and drew it on the floor. Right, he said, it's 11 o'clock, shall we go and try it? And then we modified a standard set, and in fact, there were again two stages of modification. There was one that took an hour and a half, which showed it worked. Then there was another one that took 2 days, which then became the standard for about a year, which involved, in effect, rewiring the RF switching so as to put the alternate half waves in. And then we built a device, actually the original one, we just took out the phase-sensitive rectifier and stuck wires into the valve holder and led them off to a breadboard of circuitry, which was then went onto the recorder. And that obviously worked. So the next stage was to build some standard units which plugged into the existing total power equipment and led off to recorders. They ran for a while until there was a standard phase switch set.
Now, is this breadboard that you refer to, this picture I've seen, which is a god-awful mess, if I may say so?
Oh, that's still around, is
yes.
it? No, that was, in fact, the development of the second-generation total power equipment.
Okay, so this is when it was still on the bench.
That was when it was still on the bench, yes. That's actually, I took that photograph, and that was the development of that, yeah.
I see, okay.
Yeah.
But now...
That was when we discovered I think even Martin was a bit shocked by this. EF50s were much in use then. They were vacuum tubes which got metal cans. And they had the advantage that the metal can would fit into a capacitor clip.
Yeah.
So you take a piece of wood and put a great pile of capacitor clips, put all the valves upside down in the capacitor clips, put the valve bases on, then do all the wiring on the top.
Oh, you see. I see.
And you could actually stick down the potentiometers with Bostik to the wood.
Interesting. But now, since this was such a cohesive group, you must have been part of the first Radio Star work that was done, which was on Cygnus to follow up this discovery that Hay had made and so forth.
Well, I wasn't really part of it. I was around at the time.
Well, you were part of the equipment that was being used for it.
I was part of the equipment, that's right.
Is that a better statement to make? Yeah.
And I remember them finding this other one on the record and saying, what the hell is this? No, look, it's a different periodicity. And then, of course, Martin came in the next day and said, hey, I know why it's a different periodicity. We can use that for finding
Declination.
Declination,
right.
Yeah.
But as you said in the Edge interview, even going until you finally left radio astronomy in 52 or 53, you never took a liking to this Radio Star work.
I
find this curious, because you obviously had thought that the solar work was not getting anywhere also.
I think the real difficulty is I suspect I'm a techniques man, and I enjoy the techniques almost for their own sake. There was a general feeling that in order to make a PhD thesis respectable, one had to put in some theoretical work so it looked like real science. This sort of thing annoyed me a bit, because I wasn't very strong mathematically. And I think it had got to the stage where the problem was just becoming too difficult. I was having to worry too much about what's going on the sun, and
to do this static one-dimensional transfer thing and think that you had a real representation of the sun. Is that what you...
Well, mostly that whenever one tried to set up a model, the real thing didn't look like any of the models because of the tremendous amount of fluctuations about. I mean, it is a right mess, the sun, and it was enough of a right mess to be discouraging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you were operating in the late 40s, pretty near solar maximum also, I believe.
Yeah, sure. So it was
wasn't helping
very much, yeah.
Yeah.
But in effect, when I moved to zoology, I think I probably moved as a techniques man. I think I'd really claim that the reason I've got anywhere since is because I've cooperated with biologists in which they're producing the biological background and I'm producing the physical techniques.
Mm-hmm.
When I say techniques, I don't necessarily mean hardware techniques. I mean ways of looking at things.
Yeah,
For instance, two flagellated cells swimming together, the flagella locking phase, which is Appleton and Van der Pol 1923 synchronization of triode oscillators, which is Lord Rayleigh on the synchronization of pendulum clocks. So let's pinch the mathematics and see whether it works for these as well. You know, this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think I'd probably still train to be a techniques man.
Yeah. So it really wasn't that radio astronomy... well, what was your real reason for changing fields? Because, I mean, you could have continued with techniques and radio astronomy.
No, I think not. You see, I spun out my PhD as long as it was reasonable. In fact, longer than reasonable. I got officially a 3-year grant as a research student, and then I got this 2 years with a senior DSIR award and the Isaac Newton studentship concurrently, plus 2 periods of 6 months off sorting out things when my parents died. So that came to 6 years. And then I was going to need some money to stay on, and I just don't think I was good enough to go on to get postdoc sources of money. And there weren't many going. In fact, what one had to do by then, I suppose, was to get a university appointment. I, in fact, tried for a demonstratorship, which is the same as an assistant directorship, a year after I left, and I didn't get it. I think I wasn't good enough. And I wanted to stay in Cambridge. And I was chief instructor of the gliding club, and John Pringle was president, and so he said, come and do some physics and zoology there.
And since you're interested more in techniques than the real science that's being used for it, then that was perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, sure.
You weren't in love with astronomy, you were
in fact, in love with techniques.
I
was in love with radio research.
And methods,
The radio research was applied to the sun. When it got to the stage where the sun was so difficult and the radio research had rather stopped, etc.
Sure.
I wasn't really interested in astronomy, I think. Well, I would like to know how the sun works, and I'm really not very sure whether anybody knows yet. Can anybody give a nice, convincing, tidy, thoroughly explaining everything explanation of sunspot radiation nowadays?
There are more puzzles now than there were then. I mean, and of course the whole neutrino business makes you not certain what's going on inside.
But I mean, even given an ionized atmosphere and a magnetic field and some turbulence on all scales, even if one stops there, is it possible to give a respectable explanation of sunspot radiation?
I don't really know the answer to that question.
Yeah.
It's such a specialized field by itself.
I was suspicious. What I managed to do ever since is to be fairly early on in the field, and as soon as it started getting difficult, get out and leave it to the Americans, if you see what I mean.
Speaking of the Americans, but really more the Australians, I'd be interested in relationships with other groups and how much what they were doing was influencing what you were doing. Now, you mentioned, for instance, that Pawsey visited at least once or twice. And you remembered him staying for a long period even one time.
Well, I remembered him staying for a long period, but that doesn't prove he did.
Right.
It could be my memory.
But did the news that he brought of what's going on in Australia influence what you did at all? Or was it just
By that stage, all they were doing was the same as us, only vertically, and we were doing it horizontally, if you see what I mean. In other words, they got their cliff interferometer, and we got our horizontally spaced interferometer, and things were coming in much the same.
So in terms of seeing an article in Nature or a preprint, this did not influence you saying, oh, they've got this, now we've got to do that, or...
Don't think it was at that stage. In other words, I think there was enough going that we could keep on our own lines and didn't feel we had to.
Mm-hmm.
It's unlike the pulsar thing, in which, my God, let's do something quick. Or even the Russian satellite thing, where the whole group switched within a day.
Right.
Oddly enough, I came back out of zoology and joined
them. Oh, did you really?
Because I had a frequency meter that I was using for measuring wingbeat frequencies in bees, you see, and they got to hear about that, and they wanted a frequency meter for measuring the Doppler frequency.
Well, that must have been fun for you. Yeah, several people have told me what a fantastic experience that was.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
But there wasn't any of that in those days because there seemed to be enough for everybody, if you see what I mean.
It was such a virgin territory that
you could just... And quite a lot of it was just stamp collecting. In other words, the daily changes of solar intensity, okay, we'll list these because one of these days we may be able to do something with them.
Mm-hmm. So then really... correspondence, preprints, this kind of thing was not an important part of your research.
No, I think we were very influenced by that SMERD paper, that model of the corona.
Which was in the Proceedings of the IEEE.
That's right, yes. But it was around in preprint form quite a long time before that. In fact, the thing I've lent to you was the preprint that we got. And that meant that we got the nearest that was going to hard data on the corona, and we could start thinking about models of the quiet sun from that and so on. And of course, it's all very well, but if every figure is read as yes, plus or minus a factor of 10, it's quite a good representation of the corona. Right. But we didn't know that at the time. We were all simple-minded, and we worked out nice things. Well, if the power law is 3.7, it'll look like this, and if it's 4.5, it'll look like this, and the answer is it'll look like neither.
Speaking of interpretation of the sun, could you please tell me the anecdote about the Kapitsa Club?
As you remember. Background of the Kapitsa Club was that it was formed before the war when Kapitsa was here, and it went on after the war, and it was a club for senior research people in the Cavendish, and one joined by invitation, and I got in, I suppose, in about 49 or something like that. There was either a paper by Fred Hoyle and Martin Ryle was in the audience, or more likely a paper by Martin Ryle and Fred Hoyle was in the audience. The controversy then was about the difficulty with sunspot radiation, but if you could get it generated, then the region of generation was overlaid by so much electron density that stuff couldn't get out. Or alternatively, if you went to a region where the radiation could get through, then there was no mechanism for generating it. And I think Fred was running some mechanism, which now escapes me, for generating this stuff, and Martin Ryle said, but what about all the electrons over it? And Fred would sort of go on regardless, and Martin Ryle finally said, 10 to the fifth kilometres of imaginary refractive index. And the whole thing broke up in confusion. It was quite good-natured, but not entirely good-natured. Yeah. The relationship between those two particularly was quite edgy.
Well, that's what, of course, why I'm interested in particular, because later on it grew very bitter almost, I think is a proper word.
Sure.
And I think there were signs of it already in the late 40s.
I think all the time we got the feeling that we were a bit like the nuclear physicists, you know. The engineers and physicists would get some results, and the theoreticians would come and collect them and go away and have a theory in about 10 days, because they didn't have to go and dig any holes in fields. They got nothing else to do. And so they beat us to the ideas. And I think we were very sensitive that we were the people who were producing results. And producing results does mean building apparatus and digging holes in fields.
Yes.
And what we'd like is a little bit of time to think about them. We didn't particularly want merely to act as a sort of fodder machine, producing data which were fed into the theoreticians, who would then crack it all.
Yeah.
And I think we were a little bit cagey. I can't actually quote any instances of anything that we would regard as improper, though I think they probably did happen.
This is what led to the renowned secretiveness, you think, in some extent, of the Cambridge Group?
Maybe. I think that our early experience, and as I say, I can't put my finger on any incidents, but whenever there was a theoretician around, there was a sort of air of tension, a slight sort of lock up the filing cabinets chat. Just because we were, I think, probably knocked on one occasion by somebody coming along and saying, well, what have you done today? We would tell them, and then a fortnight later they would publish a paper on it.
So it's really more a matter of of this, you think, than the personal thing between Ryle and Hoyle?
I think there was a bit of a personal thing. I mean, their style was so different.
How would you describe the styles?
Well, Fred was not much afflicted by humility, should we say. And the typical sort of thing was a set of lectures he gave on the radio called The New Cosmology. And
this is now what era?
About 1950, I guess. The New Cosmology, of course, being continuous creation, steady state, and so on and so forth, presented absolutely deadpan, without any suggestion that there might be any other views, without any suggestion that this is, in fact, Hoyle, Bondi and Gold's ideas, without any attempt to fit it into the picture, and so on and so forth. bloody arrogant, not to put too fine a point on it.
Yeah, yeah. And Martin, on the other hand, how would you describe his overall style in contrast to that?
Well, trouble is, we just idolized him early on. He was so...